Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Lily Simpson.
My name is Sonia Rappaport.
Today, Sonia, we are still in the X-Men Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
Seemingly, there might be no escape. We're almost at the end. We're going to talk about X-Men Apocalypse from 2016. Very interesting, controversial movie.
Yeah.
Before we do that, I want to talk about Stan Lee.
Yeah, just a quick little tribute to him here.
Right. Stan Lee, as we all know, one of the co-creators of the X-Men with Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the X-Men, not really his most famous creation at the time.
Right.
The X-Men weren't really a big hit when he created them in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
63, I believe. Early 64. More famously, or as famously, created the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, the Avengers, well, parts of the Avengers anyway, and like I said, co-created with Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, all these different characters, Thor, Doctor Strange, Daredevil,
yeah,
you know, the list is endless, Black Panther.
Yeah.
Like, a remarkable thing. He created the Fantastic Four, Jack Kirby, when he was 38 years old,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing.
Yeah, gives us some hope.
Right. Yeah.
We can still do stuff.
mid-30s, right. Yeah. It's not over yet. I went back and I reread a lot of the Marvel's Untold History. I forget, the author's name escapes me at the moment. But it's the rise of Stan Lee in the world of comic book publishing is so interesting. He got hired when he was 18 by his uncle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about who you know. Martin Goodman, the founder of Timely Enterprises or whatever it's called, or Atlas. Marvel had a lot of different names before it was Marvel.
Yeah.
And, you know, his uncle did more than just comics. It was magazines. It was like a whole world of publishing.
It was a publishing house, yeah.
Right. And comics was just a small unit of that. I think they had offices in many different buildings, like the RKO building and the Empire State Building, and then on Madison Avenue. They moved around a lot based on their success. And his uncle got enormously rich, Martin Goodman, ended up selling Marvel in the 60s at some point. But the point is, Stan Lee was related to him. He got hired when he was 18 years old, started off as like an office boy, like fetching the artists like new pencils and giving them coffee and stuff. As the world of comic books rose and fall in the 1940s when he started, and before World War II he actually started, Stan Lee's job changed a lot. He also went to World War II, and he worked in like... I think he worked at, I forget what it's called, like the Signal Post Division or something, like the whatever the division that like makes like the posters and things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he helped create like army posters. Anyway, gets back to America. He had a job waiting for him at the publishing company, and like in his early 20s still, his uncle just makes him like editor in chief of the comic books.
Good to have connections.
Right, but I just think about that, like in his early 20s, he was in charge of Marvel essentially.
Uh-huh.
And so we're going from, like, let's say age 24 to age 38. He's in charge of the comic books wing there.
Right.
And he hasn't even created the Fantastic Four yet. Like, so much time passes.
I mean, it's not that surprising. Like, his whole generation had gone to war.
Right.
Right?
But I'm just saying, like, the age...
Are you going to leave a woman in charge of that kind of thing?
Right. Well, I'm just saying, the age of him being in charge of Marvel is really young. Sorry.
Yeah,
how he's had such a long career.
Right.
That, to me, is almost impossible to fathom. And, like, the book is very interesting because they go through the highs and lows. Like, at first, the publishing comic wings of the company is very successful. And he's got, like, three beautiful secretaries and a big private office. And he would pitch stories to, like, all his assistants, and they'd have to take notes. He was, like, extremely impressive for a young man in his 20s to have all that power. And like,
his uncle gave it to him.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying, like... Well, wait till what I say next.
Okay.
So, like, he's, you know, got all, like, this incredibly fancy job at a young age.
Yeah.
Think, like, Pete Campbell from Mad Men, maybe, you know, but more wish fulfillment, because Pete's always, like, bested by Don Draper.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't have quite what Don Draper has.
Right.
Like, Stan Lee
has Don Draper's position, but he's young.
He makes enough money to buy, like, a beautiful house in the suburbs of Long Island and a car, lives, like, a playboy lifestyle, meets a model, marries her. They stay married for 70 years. His wife, Joni. She's, like, this British model he met. Like, really, like, incredible, like, fantasy life for a young man. But then the comic book business sort of goes bust in the late 40s, early 50s. I'm not quite sure when the time frame. His uncle makes Stan fire everybody slowly in the office. And Stan's like heartbroken over this. He's pretty much the only employee remaining of the comic book's wing. And he goes from like a luxurious, like Don Draper-esque office overlooking, you know, the skyline of New York to he has to go back and working in a cubicle. Mm-hmm. And he has no more secretaries. Or he may have one secretary, but like whatever at that point. It's like a big fall. Mm-hmm. And he's just making like romance comics or like crappy Western comics, you know, like nothing interesting. And he's doing it for like, they talk about in the book how he goes to that for like 7 years. He accepts that humbling after rising so high. But he just, for whatever reason, he hangs on tight to this job, mm-hmm. despite suffering that indignity. And then he just like slowly builds it up again. You know, new opportunities come. Superheroes get popular again. And he co-creates the Fantastic Four with Jack Kirby, who was never really his friend. They're just business partners, mm-hmm. you know. Jack Kirby always thought of him as like an annoying little kid mm-hmm. playing the ocarina and wearing a propeller hat in the office. They talk about that, literally.
Who can resist an ocarina?
Well, everyone. They all hated him. They thought it was annoying. You know, he's a big dork, Stan Lee. Uh-huh. But he was brilliant, you know. Stan Lee spent many decades after that. You know, he created Spider-Man, X-Men, Avengers, parts of them. Fantastic Four, as we said, Black Panther, all the characters, Doctor Strange, all these characters making billions of dollars today, collectively, the box office, dominating the cultural landscape. He creates all that. And he, you know, Marvel Comics is like a hit with teenagers and young kids mm-hmm. for generations, but they're not really featured on TV that much. You have a few series like The Incredible Hulk. They had the crappy Spider-Man live-action show, which wasn't like that much to look back at. They never made any successful Marvel movies for a long time. Stan Lee actually moved to Hollywood to set up a Marvel shop in 1980 to like try to make movies, and it took him like 15 years before anything remotely close to like cooking got going. Mm. And, you know, it's like he was probably in his 60s before they started talking about like finally adapting a live action Spider-Man movie with James Cameron, which never happened either. But and so it's like he was like this minor cult figure for all these years. And then like in his later years, he like blows up as a worldwide international celebrity, getting all this fame and recognition. Like he's a Beatle, you know. Like who else like can claim? I mean, to invent something like Spider-Man and the X-Men, these things, these enormously popular things. So it's like really like quite a ride. Like what a like marvelously strange life he had, right? And then, you know, he got to be in all these movies in the end, too, in these cameos. And everyone always, if you go to any Marvel film, everyone always applauds him when they see him, which is really kind of funny and touching.
Right.
And he was beloved. I mean, he was just like a, I mean, honestly, for me personally, he looked like my grandfather. He was a, like, my grandfather looked just like Stan Lee, a tall, lanky Jewish guy with a mustache who had, like, a vaudevillian sense of humor. World War II vet as well, you know, mm-hmm. like, sort of like a just like the similar type of man mm-hmm. and I'm sure it's like
did
some
you play the ocarina
mm-hmm. No, my uncle did play the harmonica and stuff, you know.
Your uncle?
I'm not my uncle, my grandfather. Yeah. My grandpa Abe Simpson, believe it or not, was his name.
Yeah, we talked about that
we did
before.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean Stan Lee, just for me, his death is just really sad to me. I mean, he just is someone that, you know, when you start falling in love with Marvel Comics at whatever age, eventually you learn about Stan Lee. And it's almost hard to believe that one guy came up with all the different characters.
Well, one guy didn't.
Right, you know what I mean. Well, okay, that's true. That's totally fair, right? Like, one guy largely responsible with a few other guys who are each equally largely responsible, namely Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and several others too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Stan Lee kind of at the epicenter. He was running the company. He was the editor-in-chief. He did write the stories. He did come up with a lot of the names and concepts. You know, we can get into this debate, which we've had in the podcast many times, about who deserves more credit. I think, honestly, when you read stuff like the book I mentioned, The Secret History of Marvel Comics, you realize it's like Stan, it's not like Stan deserves less credit.
No, I'm not trying to say he deserves less credit. I just think it's like hair splitting at a certain point. It's a collaboration.
Right.
So.
That's fair. Yeah. But anyway, but forget about that. Like, he's just he was a wonderfully nice man by all accounts. Uh-huh. Like a great sense of humor. I mean, that's what's funny about him. He's like a little like ball busting salesman from New York City, you know, like with a real corny sense of humor. And he kind of had an inflated ego, but he was always self-deprecating at the same time.
Yeah. that video that you posted in I didn't mean this as like to plant a plug, but in the Facebook group for X-Men Tass,
you put X-Men Tass podcast.
X-Men Tass podcast Facebook group, you put up that link for I don't know, it's like Stan Lee talking to these two like young guys. Like,
well, Todd McFarlane, one of them, right, who is like a really famous comic book artist. Yeah, who created Spawn and was a famous Spider-Man writer.
Yeah, anyway, if you haven't seen any like live Stan Lee footage, you should go check out that link because it really really gives you a good idea of his sense of humor.
And it gives you an idea of his genius. I thought like that video was amazingly like it gave me a real idea of what it must have been like to work with Stan Lee in his prime.
Uh-huh.
And here he was like already kind of an old man in the early 90s telling these guys, but they're creating a new superhero on the spot, right?
Right.
And they're drawing him and they're like giving him like this crazy outfit with body armor and tons of missiles on his hands.
Yeah.
And Stan's like, how does he like get changed in a hurry if he has to put on his costume, you know?
Like, that's like an age-old question with every superhero, you know what I mean?
But Stan was asking those questions. You know?
Asked that question the other day when we were watching like the 1960s Batman, and you see them, Batman and Robin, slide down the pole to get down to the Batcave, and it's always like they on one at the top they're in their normal clothes, and by the time they get to the bottom they're already changed. Right. You're like, how do they do that?
Right, Stanley wouldn't have approved of that. That would have been too corny for him. He's like, he wants a reason.
He wants realism,
and he wants to see the characters get changed into their clothes in a way that makes sense. And that's in a timely way.
Right.
He wants to see the characters deal with money problems. And it's not like he's thinking about it seriously. He asks it like a joke, you know? It's like, how does Spider-Man pay his rent? You know, like, that's the... But
he's talking to these two comic book artists. Yeah. He's really, like...
Letting them have it.
Yeah. To work for him, you must have really had to, like, have a lot of self-confidence and, like, nerves of steel.
Well, Stan Lee was, like, an asshole to a lot of people thought he was an asshole. But really, that to me, that video was illuminating because it's like, no, he wasn't an asshole. He's asking smart questions.
Yeah, no, he wasn't doing it to try to be mean to these guys. It was like pushing them to make their character as good as possible.
They weren't. He was showing that he was actively thinking about the character in a real world setting, and they were not. They just saw it as like a piece of like pop art, you know, with no like logic to it.
Right.
And he was an editor and an art director too. He served as art director all those years, even though himself wasn't like quite the drawing artist.
Yeah.
So that was illuminating. Everyone should check out that video. It's really amazing just to get an idea of like what this guy's sensibility was. And that sensibility really defined the entire Marvel universe. It's taking fantastic characters and asking a bunch of realistic questions at them all the time,
mm-hmm.
and then setting them in the real world too. And that's the secret of the Marvel universe.
Right.
So it's a way to relate to it and to have some humor and some fun and to really allow your imagination to get engaged in a critical way. So that's the beauty and genius of Stan Lee. And you know, it's really sad that he passed. I mean, he was 95. What a life.
Yeah.
And he, at the end of his life, he really got so much praise and so much love. That's a wonderful thing, too. Who gets that in life, right?
True.
So...
Rest in peace, Stan Lee.
Yes. What more can we say about him? Everything has been said.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to this movie. All right. X-Men Apocalypse.
2016.
I was so stoked for this movie.
Yeah, me too. I was so excited to see Apocalypse in the movies.
Really? That's the reason you were stoked?
Yeah, it was.
I was just really excited with what they set up in X-Men Days of Future Past with the new cast.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the relative satisfying conclusion of that film.
Uh-huh.
With the characters being brought back to life.
Yeah, all right.
And, you know, I knew that this movie was going to have Cyclops and Jean Grey again. I was very happy about that, and Storm. And I was like, yeah, give me James McAvoy playing Professor X, leading the team of X-Men that we know and love. And so there's a lot of reasons to get excited about it. And Apocalypse, like, sure, he's a great villain.
I think I felt like the timelines were all messed up and the cast was all different in all the movies. And I was like, all right, forget it. Like, wipe the slate clean. Now we have Apocalypse, you know?
Right.
He's like a really interesting villain.
Yeah, we're going to tell like a meaty, juicy X-Men story, regardless of all this continuity bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, we got a new cast going and it's just going to be some classic, straightforward X-Men.
Uh-huh.
And what we get instead is like, we sort of get that, but there's two...
Oscar Isaac as the Golem.
Right. This movie's too much of a mishmash, blender, rushed clusterfuck of things. of incorrect tone, of not really getting the source material just right.
It's like same complaints we have about every movie, right?
Well, not everyone. I mean, some we like more than others.
I guess, yeah. But like, I feel like there's some version of those complaints, like the more of these movies that we do.
Right. The fundamental complaint about the X-Men movies is not
enough like source material.
Not paying enough respect to the source material.
Comes from the comics, right? Yeah.
This sort of need to gloss over stuff too much,
or even the cartoon. Yeah, I mean, that holds true. Or were you about to like launch into it here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that holds true for me with the opening of this movie. They really do a montage scene when I wish they would have just spent time establishing Apocalypse and the Four Horsemen at the very beginning. And
right.
It's like so quick. They go through it so fast.
Do you want to describe it?
They open up.
Where are we?
It's like Egypt 3500 BC, right?
Okay.
So, what is that, the Old Kingdom?
Old Kingdom, maybe? Yeah. Probably the Old... Let's say the Old Kingdom.
Right.
When the pyramids were pristine.
The Egyptian people have built this pyramid for Apocalypse, and they're...
Praying en masse.
Right. Getting together a big ceremony. And we learn he's gonna switch his body. He's got, like... He's an old...
Withered Apocalypse
version of himself, and he's gonna get transferred into Oscar Isaac's body.
And the idea we have is that he's probably been doing this for hundreds, or if not thousands, of years at this point too.
They say at some point like he's been doing it for 10,000 years, right?
Yeah.
From the present day, so yeah. 6,000 years before this already, he's been doing it. Which I don't know how they know that it's that long. I forget if they like say.
Well, Moira McTaggart has a bunch of like graphs and charts
collecting evidence,
it.
I guess, yeah. From like ancient times, but I don't know. It's like this is part of what makes him so interesting as a character, is that he's like this crazy guy with a god complex, but like it blurs the line a little. Like, is he a crazy guy with a god complex, or is he a god in real life because he can do all this like crazy stuff? And
he's a mutant.
Yeah.
And if you're going by the comic book origin, the story goes, he's like the first mutant born on Earth, and I'm not exactly sure what his powers were when he was born, but the point is, I think he comes across a spaceship that was crashed by the Celestials, which are like these super powerful Marvel overlord aliens.
Right.
Maybe like a notch below Infinity and Time and Death and those characters and Galactus.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Celestials, they're super powerful. He like steals or adapts their technology and he gets the suit that augments his power or lets him live forever. I'm like, not quite sure. It's like, it's interesting.
I think it's that it augments his power because he has to transfer himself into other bodies.
Well, I remember in the cartoon, I don't know exactly what's true in the comics, he's got a Lazarus pit.
Right.
That he has to rest in for 100 years at a time occasionally.
Right, yeah.
So none of that's here. It's all like...
No.
It's hinted at, but it's like...
Yeah. Anyways, like, I just think that aspect of his personality is, like, borderline psychotic, but I like it.
Right, yeah, that's the best part of him. He speaks in these weird tomes of...
Like, he really believes it himself,
yeah.
You know?
He's got
like
a consistent philosophy and point of view.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... It's like, this movie, the opening sequence, they sort of rush over... The origin of Apocalypse, which isn't really an origin.
Right. Well, they don't give you all that information until later on. Basically, he's in the side of this pyramid. Everyone's gathered around, like, worshipping him and making
sure
that this thing is going to happen.
Yeah.
And Oscar Isaac, they show he has, like, an instant healing power.
He's like Wolverine.
I guess is what Apocalypse wants in his next body. So, whatever. They do the transfer. But then there's, like, a rebellion. Apparently, some of
the humans.
Yeah. Some of the people that, like, built the pyramid and stuff have built in some...
An elaborate pyramid-destroying thing.
Yeah, self-destruct mechanism.
That really slipped under Apocalypse's watch somehow.
Right. So...
Because it's, like, a lot of stuff they had to build, and they're hiding it under, like, fancy, elaborately woven
like
blankets.
Yeah.
And they just, like, reveal them all. There's, like, 10 of them.
They give the signal, and they all start, like, the collapse sequence of the pyramid.
Right. They accuse him of being a false god. Which, again, shows that that Apocalypse is kind of wimpy in this version, because in the cartoon, remember, he laughs at all the people's attempts at destroying him throughout the centuries.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're just as feeble as the Chinese with their fire sticks.
But I thought the point was here that he's... extra vulnerable because he's like unconscious, right, sort of while the transfer is happening.
But I just want to say, like, you know, applause to humanity for stopping
finding
him.
His one weakness.
Yeah, and killing him in the year 3500. That, yeah, really saved the world a lot of trouble there.
That's true.
Well, they don't outright kill him,
that's,
as we'll,
like,
see.
That's like 3500 years of like peace and rest for humanity to like make
more than that. 5000 years. 3500 to year zero, and then another 2000 and change. So it's all, like you said, it's like a montage of like images and ideas instead of it being a time and a place and a realistic setting so much. Like, they could have grounded it a bit more. I mean, that's...
I also wanted to see the story of the Four Horsemen because you kind of get the idea that they're helping him out, but...
They're just generic mutants.
Yeah.
You know, they don't seem... I don't know, it seems like... I don't know. It's just hard to say what's going on with Apocalypse and his followers.
Right.
You know, like, is Oscar Isaac, was he captured? Was he a willing slave?
He seems to be there willingly.
It's hard. So, well, he's unconscious, like, so I don't know.
Yeah, but then it's like, is some of humanity, like, with Apocalypse at that point? And then there's just, like, a rebellion, like, faction against him?
Right.
Or,
like what? And also, the people that lead the insurrection, they say out loud, oh, into the false god.
Yeah.
It's like, really? You think this guy's a false god?
Yeah, right.
He seems to really match the description of, like, what you might think an ancient person might see as a god.
Right.
A super powerful, weird, alien-looking dude, you know, with, like, super advanced technology, too. He's managed to harness the power of the sun and connect it to gold in some weird way.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I'm sure someone's done some research about this. I wonder in the ancient world how prevalent religion really was. Like, now there's a bunch of people that are agnostic or atheist, right, or just don't care one way or another. Like,
it's not...
there probably were people like that back then.
Well,
right?
It's funny you mention that. I've actually read a few books about ancient Egypt and, uh-huh, and ancient religion. And I would say in this era, and someone could please correct me if I'm wrong later, that it wasn't so much about a separation of religion. It was about worship of gods.
Yeah.
And each tribe, big or small, would have their own gods they worshipped.
Uh-huh.
And but it wasn't like – but the story was like if your tribe got conquered by another tribe, if you survived
– then you start worshipping those people's,
yeah,
gods.
Yeah, because obviously their god was better than yours.
Yeah, right.
Like, and – so, like, that was kind of the story of religion to a very broad stroke extent back then.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, people, like, were superstitious.
Right.
And they believed in sort of magical things and magical stories and folklore and superstitions and things. So it wasn't, like, so much about, like, a religion as we know it in the more modern sense, which started, you know, more toward the age of... like the modern Western religions, be they Judaism, Christianity,
theism.
Right? Yeah,
yeah, monotheism.
Right? Yeah, with monotheism. Right. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much that where it was like centrally organized, and it was just like more like mystic type stuff going on with people doing animal sacrifices, and but not even big animal sacrifices. Like you'd sacrifice like a chicken or like a rat or something, and mm-hmm. spill their blood and pray for good fortune, like the rain to water your crops.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, the point is Apocalypse seems to be, like, way beyond that.
Yeah, know? Right.
It's like, so...
He actually affects, like, the circumstance, you know, he has power, for sure.
Right. So, anyway, there's a rebellion. It's a pretty cool sequence visually. I enjoy looking at it. I like the scene where he's got, like, a telekinetic person,
uh-huh.
this woman who's protecting him in, like, a telekinetic shield as they're falling endlessly through this pyramid so that she puts on his armor and the body transfer is complete. And even after she's crushed, you still see the energy coming out of her hand to protect him as he's buried under rubble for thousands of years.
Right.
So, and then... and then we, like, get the CGI intro, which, you know, Bryan Singer's now taken to ridiculous levels.
Mm.
So normally in these X-Men movies, you get this weird traversing through, like, a genetic DNA spiral
mm-hmm.
or technology tunnels like the Cerebro machine. Here, it's like a CGI Disney tour through history and stupid iconography.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you see the... you know, the hammer and sickle of the Soviet Union, then you see it explode, and
yeah.
then you see,
the
like...
the Mona Lisa's in there at some point.
Right, like, then like, Nazism comes and goes.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're going through history.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, looks bad, and it's...
Heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed. But we arrive in the year 1983. So 10 years past the last one, which was 1973. 20 years past the first one, which was 1963. And by first one, I mean X-Men First Class. Mm-hmm. So it's like 20 years since the first movie. That in itself, I think, is a big problem with the film. Why this need to like continuously jump ahead decades at a time to tell this story?
Yeah, I don't know.
What's the point of casting a group of young, interesting actors to, if only to rush through their story, at least in a chronological sense? Uh-huh. What does it matter what time frame the X-Men movies take place in? And the next one, X-Men Dark Phoenix, takes place, I'm guessing, in 1993, so another 10 years. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we doing here? Like, why?
People like period piece films, I think. I think it's kind of a problem, though, because it's a superhero movie. It doesn't need to be a period piece all the time.
Right.
They tried it, and, like, fine, that's okay, but...
I mean, who would have cared if all the movies took place in the 60s? I think that would have been cool.
Yeah, right.
You've got young Professor X and young Magneto. Like, They don't have to be older.
Right.
And then, speaking of which, all right, you're going to go ahead 10 years in time. Why does Professor X still have hair? One of the easiest things you can do to age an actor is to make him bald.
Well, they did in this movie. That was right. Kind of the point, is, like, he still has hair because they want to show you the scene in which he loses his hair so that everyone who's only even marginally aware of X-Men and what Professor X looks like can be like, oh, that's how he lost his hair.
But why is his losing of his hair a dramatic plot point of the film?
Shouldn't
he just have lost his hair naturally? Like,
no.
I mean, technically in the comics, I think he starts off as a bald little kid.
That's part of the thing here, though, is that, like, some things are underexplained and kind of glossed over and rushed, and other things are, like, really overexplained.
Like the character's hair, because, like, Storm is another example.
Yeah.
Like, why does her hair need an origin story?
Right.
She should just have white hair.
Yeah.
And for that matter, Magneto, why doesn't he have white hair? And why does his son Quicksilver have white hair? The only reason Quicksilver's supposed to have the white hair is because Magneto has such shockingly white hair that it's a characteristic trait, like, passed on to his child.
Yeah.
And it's like, we did the math with this movie. We figured that if Magneto was, let's say he was 15 when we first see him in the concentration camp in 1940, let's say it's 1943 to keep, like, the years even.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked out that he would be, like, 55 by this movie. He'd be in his mid-50s, and so would Professor X, and so would Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
And so would Moira McTaggart. They'd all be in their mid-50s.
Right.
And, like, they all look glamorously young and beautiful for their age.
Right.
And I just don't get why they had to jump ahead 10 years at all. You know, like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
The only thing I can think is, like, they're starting to introduce some new characters, and they're, like, trying to adhere to the timeline in which they were introduced or something. Like, Jubilee is, like, an 80s character, so now
they're
She's,
like,
80s.
A late 80s character, early 90s, I would dare say.
So...
She's, like, an 80s mall rat. That's not quite an early 80s thing, really.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to split hairs, which I kind of do on this film, I just think that they would have been fine if all the movies took place in a melange of the 60s and 70s.
I agree. Just...
It, like, I don't know, Beast is supposed to be in his mid-40s, technically, you know, Havoc too.
Right.
Alright, so we all know the ages are all screwed up. Alright, so the movie, like, in the present day, we're introduced to Cyclops, so he...
Present day being 1983.
This is his second origin story, because the first origin story we got was in X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Right.
Where he's also in high school, and in that version he had his red sunglasses.
Yeah.
In this version he doesn't have glasses yet, his eyeballs just hurt. His history teacher, Ali Sheedy, is, like, pissed at him for disrupting class, even though it didn't seem like he was being that disruptive.
Yeah.
And she sends him to the bathroom. That's when his powers wake up. And it's quite dramatic. He, like, nearly kills a bully that's picking on him.
Mm-hmm.
So Cyclops is played by Ty Sheridan, who's a young up-and-coming actor here. He was in Ready Player One. How do you feel about this portrayal or presentation of Cyclops?
It's fine.
Yeah, I'd say...
I know you have some problems, but
right.
You're a bigger Cyclops fan than I am. I think that he, like... has a little bit of Cyclops's, like, I don't know. You start talking about it because
yeah,
you have some
I have stronger
feelings.
I have stronger
I have to
opinions
work it
than
out.
You, I think.
Go ahead.
I think I think the tone of Cyclops is wrong here. I don't know how else to put it. I think the actor does a fine job, and I think all these criticisms also apply to my to Sophie Turner as Jean Grey. There's just something wrong with the character of Cyclops in this movie. He's just playing an 80s every teen.
Yeah.
Almost a Marty McFly type character. Not given as much character as Marty McFly. Like, he doesn't have enough lines to give him much of a personality.
Yeah.
But what you do get of him, he just seems kind of like he chafes at authority a little bit, but not too much. He's kind of surprised to be where he is, you know, at the X-Mansion and being an X-Man.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have any distinguishing characteristics that we know from the comics. Like, he's not overly brooding about his power. He's just a little afraid of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, in the comics, when he's introduced, he's a really brooding guy. He's self-loathing, is how I've described him, because his power is so dangerous. And he doesn't want to get close to anybody, because he's just afraid of killing everyone, and he just hates himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't really lean into that too much here. They just kind of make him a little bit of a wise ass.
Yeah.
Which is not really what Cyclops is, you know? He's either, like, really self-loathing, or he's a really confident leader that's really up Professor X's butt, you know?
They do... Yeah, right.
He's like an evangelist for mutant rights in the X-Men.
They do give him some, unearned authority in this.
Occasionally, this movie, yeah. Like,
he really does, like, take charge and start giving orders to people, even though it's not necessarily warranted.
Right, but it's not even in a way that, that doesn't even stick out. That's more subtle, too. So, I don't know, his character's just weak. That's a good way of putting it. It's just not, it's not a strong representation of what we know the character to be. And I don't think it's the actor's fault.
I mean, I think Cyclops in the comics and the TV show is like a little, he's kind of boring, you know? He's like kind of preppy and stiff and like that. And
do you think he was like boring in the cartoon?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say he was boring. I think the character was more or less accurate in the cartoon.
I know. For, you love Cyclops. So
it's not even about loving Cyclops. I actually loved him less in our run-through of the cartoons this time. Yeah, I was like, okay. Like, it's not as quite as cool as I remember him being.
Okay.
Trust me, in the comics, he's got way more to do, and he's got way more complexion to his personality.
Okay.
You know? But in the cartoon, it's like, it was pretty accurate to what he was at the time, the early 90s, what was going on with him in the comic books. He was just, he was like a really earnest, do-gooding leader.
Yeah.
Who ruffles around with Wolverine, right. You know? And he's got a deep, passionate love for Jean Grey.
There's nothing, like, too complex about him, you know?
He's like a...
Until they start giving you the backstory... Like, right. The orphanage and, yeah. And like that, which, you know, they're not going to get into in this movie.
Not so much.
And even, like, aside from the episodes that go into that specifically,
yeah,
he's boring.
He's like, you know what a good analogy Cyclops was for a long time? Mm-hmm. They've really updated him in the past 20 years in the comics.
Yeah.
But, like, I'd say from, like, the giant-sized X-Men until the Jim Lee era, Cyclops was kind of like the Captain America of the X-Men.
Yeah, right.
He was just a really, like, earnest... good-hearted superhero who was smart and tactical and didn't like weird, like, angry loners like Wolverine who wouldn't fall in line.
Right.
But, you know, there's still dimension to his personality.
Okay.
You know, he cared deeply about stuff. Like, that was the trait. He was passionate.
Right.
And that was true with his loves, too. Like, with Jean, he really, like, loved her earnestly, like, and purely, not with any, like, doubt or hesitation or with, like, any sense of being a cad, you know? So he's just like a good guy.
Yeah.
In this movie, he's like not a bad guy, but he's just kind of like a, I don't know what he's supposed to be. Like I said, it's just kind of weak overall.
I mean, he's finding out what he's about. That's
right. It's a self-discovery, but you know,
good thing that his big brother is there to like show him the way a little bit.
Right. So his 42-year-old brother Havoc, right. Vietnam veteran, is in this movie, again, his character has no personality whatsoever,
yeah.
And his power doesn't look right to me either. I don't like that the their ages are flipped in the movie universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cyclops is the older brother. It's just, none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't get much character there. Also, we get reintroduced to Nightcrawler, played by an actor named Cody Smit McPhee. He's pretty much doing the Nightcrawler from X-Men 2.
Yeah.
Do you remember that actor's name? He's very famous. It's driving me crazy that I can't remember. Anyway,
it'll come to us.
He's from GoldenEye. He's pretty much just like doing like a prequel to that character in like almost every sense. Like the way he introduces himself, he's like, "By the way, my name is Kurt Wagner."
Yeah,
you know, and he's like very nice and good-hearted. You know, he looks appropriately weird.
I like the hairstyle they gave him. I know that's like really nitpicky.
No, I agree. No, you're right. No, I don't like the hairstyle. They shoehorned every. They wanted to do an 80s period piece. That's what it comes down to. You hinted at that before. And so they gave Nightcrawler like a Flock of Seagulls haircut. And you know, his power looks right. It's fine. But again, it's just kind of like he's just a background character in this movie, like a lot of characters, you know. He's kind of present but pushed to the side.
Yeah. Alan Cumming,
yeah, right. Good pull. So he's like been captured in Germany. He's being forced to fight in this underground German mutant fighting arena, which seems pretty evil. Like it's guarded with guys with machine guns, and they throw them into this electrified cage, which seems to cancel out mutant powers. At least it cancels out his power of teleporting.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to fight Angel, who is he Warren Worthington III in this movie? We never find out.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Kinberg, I read in one of the Amazon trivia things, says that the timeline screw-ups of Days of Future Past allowed all the characters that we saw in the previous X-Men films to change. So people are born at different times, they have different identities, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll see the Angel kill the Blob, which is a more accurate... just the brief glimpse we get of him, he's wearing the comic book costume of the Blob.
Yeah.
The big, like, blue, like, spandex with the yellow waistband. Yeah. So, you know, Angel's played by this guy named Ben Hardy. He's barely got a role in this film.
Yeah.
He's just there as background decoration.
Right.
You know, there's nothing to the character of Angel in this movie. So they're fighting, and then meanwhile, Jennifer Lawrence's back is Mystique. And she rescues... She's there to, like, shut down this mutant fighting ring and rescue Nightcrawler.
Mm-hmm.
And I just...
Does she know he's her son?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's...
Or not. They don't acknowledge it whatsoever, but...
Right. There's... I just don't... This is, to me, the beginning of the end for giving any tolerance to the Mystique character. She's... Jennifer Lawrence is really bad in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I really blame the script more than her. But... I guess she's playing it the best that the script is presenting it as, but it's just really stupid. Like, when she rescues Nightcrawler, Nightcrawler says, "You're her, the hero." And she replies as, like, coolly as possible, "I'm nobody." And does a bunch of badass stuff and, like, fights her way out of there.
Yeah.
And I just, like, hate the way she's presented. Like, she's the Fonz or something, you know? She's this too cool for school superhero that's out, like...
Because she's famous, because she was on TV.
Right. She saved the president.
Future past,
right.
Yeah.
She's a real iconoclast now.
Right.
It's just bizarre, and it just strikes a wrong note for Mystique in every possible way.
Right. She's supposed to be extremely discreet.
Right.
In her personality.
And kind of borderline sneaky and evil.
Right.
And in this movie, she's a full-blown superhero. She's actually more like Cyclops.
Right.
Than any other character should be. She ends up leading the team at the end and orders them around with really, like, Cyclops-esque dialogue.
Yeah.
You know? It's just... None of it makes sense. And this is, like, the ultimate... I think it speaks to the ultimate fault of the movie. Which is that because they felt obligated to keep certain star actors like Michael Fassbender as Magneto, Jennifer Lawrence as Mystique. You got to have James McAvoy, obviously, as Professor X.
Yeah.
Nicholas Hoult even as Beast. When you keep these people around, it pushes the new characters you want to introduce that are the main X-Men to the margins of the film.
Mm.
And then because these people have to center in the film, they're getting the roles that these other characters should have.
Yeah.
And it's just because you want these people in the movie. And it just doesn't work. And the problem is that the reason people are reacting so negatively, I think, to the Dark Phoenix trailers is because it seems like all those problems of X-Men Apocalypse are in Dark Phoenix times a million.
Right.
Because it's still...
It's like way too much going on.
Yeah, it's still Magneto, Mystique, you know, like all these characters, like they haven't moved on.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't make any sense. So that's a problem.
In the beginning of the movie, it's like pretty clear. I think towards the end, it starts getting very muddy with who's doing what, where, and
for
when.
Why. Yeah,
just all the questions that come up are—it's too much.
Right.
But anyway, like we're not there yet. You know, like this part of the movie, they at least have like some cohesive strings of storytelling.
Yeah, I guess. And so now we catch up with Magneto.
Uh-huh.
He's living a quiet life in Poland. He got married and has a daughter who's got the mutant ability to control animals or speak to animals or something.
Yeah.
He's living a really peaceful life as an iron worker, ironically, I guess. And, you know, he seems pretty happy.
Mm-hmm.
He's supposed to be 55, yet he looks like a beautiful 35, you know, like auburn hair.
Yeah.
He should, like I said, why no white hair?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really stupid. A real missed opportunity there. And then, you know, we were, like, jumping around to all these different characters, seeing what they're up to. We see Beast again at the X-Mansion.
He's teaching classes there.
Right. That's where Havoc brings Cyclops, his younger brother, to the X-Mansion. Eventually, Beast invents his visor for him.
Mm-hmm.
We see... Cyclops runs into Jean Grey, his future true love.
Right.
And they kind of have this, like, angsty reaction to each other.
Right. Well, they, like... Yeah, they bicker a little bit, but he has bandages over his eyes, so he can't see her. But then, like,
can't see how beautiful she is.
Right. So that's the thing. Once he gets the ruby quartz glasses and he sees her for the first time, he doesn't realize it's her. He's like, "Who's that?" You know.
Yeah.
So they're giving this little impression of like love at first sight, maybe. But
right, she's intrigued by him.
Yeah.
She plays the character again. She plays the character sort of realistically. In a weird way,
yeah.
But I don't think it works for Jean Grey, the character.
I think it's just hard for me to imagine Jean Grey as really young. I actually like Sophie Turner in this role a lot. I know there's been a lot of controversy about her, but I think like she does play it well. I think it's pretty subdued, which is totally like on the mark for me.
Yeah,
I just think like whenever you see Jean Grey in like the comics or in the cartoon, she's very mature already. And I don't mean to say, like, oh, she's old, but to see her as a teenager is, like, a little unexpected.
Here's what I'll say about all this. I think Sophie Turner is fine as Jean Grey.
Yeah.
I think the problem for me is similar to Cyclops. It's just the tone is off for the characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Jean, as a teenager in the comics, I mean, there wasn't much to her when Stan and Jack invented her in the first place. She's just the female hero.
Yeah.
And kind of ditzy. I mean, they obviously gave her way more depth going forward, especially Chris Claremont gave her way more depth when he starts the whole Phoenix saga.
Right.
But the point about Jean is that she's not as angsty, you know? Mm-hmm. She doesn't have a chip on her shoulder. She's not afraid of her powers. She's cool.
Yeah.
And she's calm, and you see where her maturity comes from.
Right.
Like, she's another character like Cyclops that is kind of boring in that way, that she's just a well-together, mature person in the end,
mm-hmm.
who's earnest and passionate about her husband, Cyclops, and who is, like, another, like, really pure-hearted superhero.
Right.
There's not, like, really much more to say about Jean other than that. I mean, what gets interesting about her is the Phoenix Saga, which is all about her, like, emerging into adulthood in a more, like, crazy way. You know, that was, like, a whole metaphor for that.
Yeah.
But past the Phoenix Saga, too, Jean Grey, the character, is, like, she's just, like, a confident, strong woman. And so here is the young Jean Grey. It's like I said, they're playing it more realistically because it's like, imagine a young girl with telekinesis and telepathy, like how hard that must be for her. She could read the minds of everybody. Mm-hmm. She knows everyone's secrets, and she's probably a little weird and like almost like a borderline witch or something, or people see her as a witch.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it hard for her to have friends and things like that. You know, she's isolated. Like, you get all those notes in her character.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying is bad, but it's just, when you give her all the other trappings of Jean Grey with the red hair and the romance with Cyclops and just the powers in general,
mm-hmm.
it just, I can't help but notice it not being correct, for lack of a better word, you know? It just doesn't, I just feel that if someone cared more about the comics, they would just, it would just fit together more nicely. You know, there's a way, you don't have to, like, create a new personality for Jean Grey to, it's for this performance, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the sense I get from Jean. It's just like a little off, you know?
Like, I don't feel like anybody tried to create a new personality for her, but like you were saying, Sophie Turner studied Femke Janssen's performance as Jean Grey, rather than studying the original comic or cartoon material or
much
whatever.
Like the guy doing Nightcrawler based it off of Alan Cumming.
Exactly. And I think, like, that's for the sake of continuity within the MCU.
Right. Well, the XCU, not the MCU.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And it's successful in that endeavor. So, I don't know.
For like 80s versions of the characters, I think it makes sense because they're trying to show them as like 80s teenage lovers from like an 80s movie, you know, kind of thing. You know what I mean? They're playing archetypes like that.
Right.
They're pulling on those tropes. When to me, it's like, you know, the X-Men are not about the eras in which they're written so much. It's just the consistency of character throughout many different eras and just slightly updating the surroundings.
Yeah.
That's what this movie confuses in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, the X-Men, the story stretches out across all these decades, touching on these historical events. Wouldn't it be clever of us to integrate that by jumping the timeline every 10 years between movies to sort of reflect that?
Mm-hmm.
But that was just kind of like missing the point a little bit.
Yeah.
The point is
just
like
a distraction.
Right. The characters are the strong, they're the single thread of continuity.
Right.
Just because Marvel Comics existed for 60 years, you don't like need to necessarily reflect that in a film.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this goes back to why Legion's a good show.
Yeah.
Because it's just like the
timeless.
World. Right. The world it inhabits is this weird like Marvel world of
it's
like
a mix of like 60s
and future
and futurism.
It's like the same thing with the Batman cartoon. It's a mix of like 1940s with the future.
Right.
It just
so cool.
Is what it is. You know, the X-Men should exist in some place like that.
Right.
So. Okay, you know, whatever. That's our complaining about all our new main characters for the most part. We'll get to a few more as we go on. And again, we're reintroduced to James McAvoy's Professor X. He's at least he's in the wheelchair in this movie.
Right. He's consistent.
You know, he's got... I just don't get... Like, they said in the Amazon trivia that he wanted to shave his head going back to the first movie.
Yeah.
He's really excited to play a bald character.
Yeah, they should have let him do it.
Like, he gets bald in this movie, but, like, the majority of this movie, he's got his hair. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why does he? Why can he have just have aged and lost his hair?
Yeah.
At least by the third movie, which this is, right? Like, doesn't that?
Or
just,
by the first movie,
right?
That's like the character.
I just don't understand. Like, it just smacks of a studio note of like James McAvoy just looks so much more handsome with his hair.
Right.
We've got it. We like got to give it. Let him have his hair as long as possible. You know, he's this, like, hot young actor. Like, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was his agent was secretly saying he can't lose his hair.
Yeah.
Despite what the actor said.
Right.
Like, I don't know. Like, why this hair? And again, he's technically a 55-year-old man in this movie. And he looks... You know what the thing that struck me? We saw, like many people, Mission Impossible Fallout this summer. And Tom Cruise is a 55-year-old man.
Right.
Who... has had a lot of plastic surgery now at this point
right.
to try to look like what James McAvoy looks like now, which is a man in his early to mid-30s,
right.
whatever it might be. And it's like, this is a universe where Michael Fassbender, Moira McTaggart, Rose Byrne as Moira McTaggart, and James McAvoy all got the same plastic surgery Tom Cruise got
right.
in the present day to like look so youthful in their mid-50s,
yeah.
you know, and dye their hair regularly, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that struck me. And also, just as like the outfits he wears, he's dressing like a man in his early 30s.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, dressing
like
Miami Vice character. You
yeah,
know,
right.
A
well,
blazer and like a turquoise T-shirt.
Whatever. It's like you said, Days of Future Past happened, and all the timelines are messed up, so no one's their right age or in their right timeline. So just
right.
accept.
I guess.
Or don't.
I can't really accept it. It's too incongruent.
Yeah.
So, and then the other plot line in this movie, we reintroduced to Moira McTaggart, who wasn't in the last one. She's back. She's also in her mid-50s, but she looks amazing as Professor X, like, has to note. It's it's played up as a joke.
Yeah.
But, like, really, they had to see something, because
right.
it doesn't make any sense. She's a CIA field operative still, and that bothered both of us that she's not a scientist, a Scottish scientist.
Yeah, hate that.
She might hint at her son, Proteus. We don't know. So she's in Egypt on a mission to investigate, I guess, Apocalypse. There's a cult worshipping Apocalypse in the present day.
Right.
She stumbles upon, like, she's just there at the right time to stumble upon Apocalypse waking up across the world, you know.
I thought she was looking for that.
She was, but, like, she just happens to be there on the day when the cult succeeds in reawakening apocalypse. Uh-huh. I'm just saying it's like a big coincidence. This movie has a lot of big coincidences.
It's not a big coincidence. She was studying it and looking for it.
I know, but like when she stumbles upon it, the cult like just happens to be doing the session where it works, the magic works.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
Like, and she walks in at like the 10-minute interval,
moment.
Right? Yeah. So Apocalypse wakes up. His awakening is felt around the entire world. We see Jean Grey react to it in her room. Like, she melts all the paintings in her room late at night, and she's really terrified by it. And we get hints of the Phoenix stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
It affects, like, really, it mainly affects Magneto. He's working at the steel factory, and it causes it, like, an earthquake, a minor one. And a big, like, cauldron of, like, burning lava is about to pour in some guy. And he, you know,
uses his power to save
the guy. Raises his arm.
Yeah.
Which I guess is an instinct for him. He has to raise his arm to use his power.
Mm-hmm.
But, I wonder if he could have been more discreet if he didn't have to raise his arm and just a floating cauldron.
Right. But anyway, people notice he's outed.
Yeah, himself. He's immediately outed. He plans to escape that night, but his daughters run away in the woods. The Polish police have her. And as I've discussed many times in this podcast, I like that they refer to him as Magneto, the Polish pronunciation.
Uh-huh.
They're not wearing any metal, so he can't attack them. He's going to go peacefully, though, just to protect his family. He's probably thinking, I'll just escape later.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be really easy for me.
So true.
But his daughter, though, like, she summons a bunch of hawks to attack these guys. And one of the guys shoots both the daughter and his wife with a bow and arrow right through the heart.
Yeah.
Which is super...
By accident.
Right.
Because they're, like, being attacked by hawks, but...
Yeah. It's super random and sad.
Yeah. So now Magneto's lost the family that he's built.
The sense of normalcy, you know, that's all out the window.
He goes insane and
screams at God.
Yeah. His daughter's locket to...
decapitate.
Shoot... through the necks of all these guys and kill them instantly. And then he's the only one left.
Right. And that's actually really fucked up, actually. You know? But again, it's like, why is Magneto in this movie? You know, like, it's just... It's such a waste.
Yeah.
And especially what the arc of his character is, that he essentially ends up being a lackey for Apocalypse, which is just so stupid to see such a powerful actor and character like Michael Fassbender just be a side henchman for Apocalypse. Almost an unthinking henchman.
Yeah.
And I can't tell when Apocalypse emerges if he's brainwashing his horsemen or if they're just willingly following him. That's difficult to see. I don't think they're brainwashed.
I don't think so either. I don't think he really has brainwashing powers.
He's
a persuasive talker.
Right.
But, like, that's about it.
So it's just the whole, again, the character Magneto is very weakened in this movie. His will, his agency... It just doesn't make any sense. It's like the point, like, why is he in the movie? Make it about...
A lot of bad stuff has happened to him.
Yeah, I know, but, like, but make it about Apocalypse, this movie. We don't need to see Michael Fassbender.
Totally.
Like, if he's in the movie, make him... Have him be as, like, a glorified cameo at the end where he helps the X-Men. Like, maybe Charles reaches out to him.
Right.
And says, like, you gotta, you know, like, help us, you know, and he emerges.
Yeah.
But, like, even then, that would have been kind of stupid. But I, the fact that he's a major character doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
Well,
they've got him all, like, intertwined with the other characters. Like, he's the reason that Mystique, like, comes back to the X-Mansion and joins up with them.
But this
is inspires the younger generation.
But again, this is the problem with the movie when you've got all these awesome superstars.
Yeah.
It's like you need to give them screen time that you otherwise would have been giving to Cyclops and Jean and Nightcrawler to do character development.
Develop their characters.
And Jubilee and Storm, you know?
Right.
And so, I mean, none of that can really happen because you have to give Michael Fassbender and Jennifer Lawrence their, like, due starring roles.
Yeah.
So Apocalypse has woken up in the modern world. It's like, okay, we got to talk about Oscar Isaac as Apocalypse.
Okay.
How do you feel he looks as the character? I mean, that's just like a huge debate that goes back to the beginning of his first image on the magazine cover.
I know. I really like Oscar Isaac as an actor.
He's lost in this role.
You don't see him at all.
Or hear him.
The makeup and costume are ridiculous.
It could be anybody under that latex.
Which isn't even the problem for me. It's just like the costume and the makeup are really clunky. It's like... It's a joke. It's like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right.
The movie.
I mean, the joke that was, he looks like Ivan Ooze from the Power Rangers movie.
Yeah.
But you're right. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like a character from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When everything else around him is so serious and so self-serious, it's like hard to take him seriously in that get-up they've got him in.
Yeah.
And also they, you know, like...
He's weirdly earthbound in this performance.
Yeah.
He just, like, can walk around slowly. Like, luckily, I guess he has the power to teleport or something.
Like, yeah, he makes those portals.
Right.
So he can, like, go places. I wish they would give him the power to get bigger and smaller,
yeah,
like he can do in the comics, but they only do it on, like, the mental plane, the psychological plane.
Right.
We'll
talk more about that later. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's just, it's a shame because he's a great actor. And
the only thing I'll say
another
is, like,
A-list character in the X-Men universe,
totally.
A-list actor.
They do give him these, like, soliloquies sometimes, or these, like, dramatic, persuasive speeches that he delivers to people, and, like... For those, I think, like, you do get to see Oscar Isaac's acting chops.
And that's the only time the character works, too.
Right, because those things could really go off the rails quick if you had someone less skillful in that role. But it's believable that he's this, like, egomaniacal, like, god-complex
right.
mutant, you know, because, like, Oscar Isaac really sells that part.
Yeah, he does, but the script is bad.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so, for instance, Apocalypse wakes up. He stumbles across Storm on the streets of modern-day Cairo. Storm is a street urchin, which is accurate to the comics. She's got her mohawk,
uh-huh,
which is kind of true to her younger self, maybe.
She should have the white hair already.
Right.
They make it a point to give it to her,
yeah,
here,
but crazy.
Whatever.
You know, he kills some guys that were trying to, like, catch Storm from stealing. And Storm takes him back to her hangout. He notices the picture of Mystique on the wall. She's an international hero to mutants everywhere, oppressed mutants. And then Apocalypse starts watching television.
And absorbing television,
I
guess.
He puts his hand on a TV, like a, you know, an old tube television that has an antenna, and somehow can absorb all the world's knowledge.
Yeah, the screen
and language.
Goes static, and you see, like, a little montage of him, like, catching up on the last... 5,500 years of
information.
History.
Yeah, by the way, he was watching an episode of Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah, now he knows everything.
The episode of where Apollo, like, the Star Trek team finds the ancient Greek god Apollo living on some other planet.
Yeah.
It's a small, like, connection there. But, yeah, that's just super dumb when he touches the TV and learns about
so cheesy.
The world. I mean, like, there's got to be a better way for him to show that he's just all-knowing.
Yeah.
Maybe he just... I don't know how he does it, but...
I don't think you even need to, like, show it. You could write it into the dialogue so easily. Just let him, like, drop some hints that he knows stuff that, like, it's inexplicable.
He could have said, like, I was buried on all those years and I absorbed all the information.
Whatever.
Right.
Know?
You know, that's, like, a way better idea, right? That,
yeah,
like, I heard the whole world transform. I know what's going on.
Yeah.
He does, like, interestingly, like, spout some good philosophy about, he doesn't like that the world is run, it's a world of systems run by weak people and weak men. And the
How
way
poignant.
Right, and the way they protect their world is through nuclear missiles.
Yeah,
and that's kind of like an interesting like thing that would bother him.
Uh-huh.
You know, like that's how he thinks it's all controlled is through these nuclear missiles, and he's going to put a stop to that.
Yeah,
as we'll see. Anyway, Storm is like, "Oh, you're kind of interesting, weirdly," and he's like, "Oh, let me give you more power."
Yeah,
which is like the whole thing of him giving characters more power is not really like quite. Does it seem that clear?
Yeah.
The characters just seem to have what powers they have anyway. You know, like, Storm doesn't show any, like, extra power. Well, whatever. And the main thing is he changes people's hairstyles and gives them body armor,
uh-huh,
you know, like, magically somehow.
Right.
He's got the power to, like, create clothing.
Wardrobe change.
Right. And affect people's hair. You know, it's just, like, there's just a lot of, like, inconsistent character stuff going on. You know, at one point when Professor X is, like, the kids are all awake in the middle of the night because of the apocalypse waking up earthquake that affects the whole world.
Yeah.
He's like, to bed, children, spit spot, to bed, everybody.
Uh-huh.
And he's so British.
You didn't like that?
No, because I'm like, everything
grew
I know
up
about...
in America.
Yeah, he's been in America since he's 9, right? Like, what is he... Why is he so overwhelmingly British? I don't know. I find that strange. I don't think Professor X is inherently a British character. I think he is. I think he has British parents or, you know, Scottish parents or something.
Mm-hmm.
But he himself is like a weird amalgam of British, you know, Scottish and American.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. That's just a small thing that bothers me. What happens next? Then, like, we're introduced to Psylocke, essentially, played by Olivia Munn. Mm-hmm. Another wasted, terrible performance role. You know?
She's not written with any personality.
She's written with nothing. She almost has no lines of dialogue in the movie.
Yeah, they make her a bad guy for some reason.
Right. They give her a completely comic-accurate costume.
Yeah.
Purple highlights in her hair. She doesn't have them right away. Apocalypse gives them to her. You know, her psionic blade, to me, does not look right. They give her more of a psionic sword.
Yeah.
It should be like a little dagger coming out of her hand, which I always thought looked cooler. I hate when they give her that long blade thing.
Right.
And she's inexplicably a bad guy.
Yeah.
And forget about her interesting origin where she started as a Caucasian British lady that got body swapped with a ninja assassin.
Yeah.
Japanese woman, or maybe Chinese. I don't know. But the point is, like, that's interesting. That's out the window, you know? Her name of Betsy Braddock is never spoken once.
Right.
Also never spoken, I read in this movie, is that Storm is never mentioned either by the name of Storm or Aurora Monroe, which is bizarre.
Hmm.
Her name is never said out loud.
That is weird.
Yeah. So Psylocke is like a nothing character along with Angel. So, and Storm really doesn't have much to do in this movie either.
Yeah.
You know, like, I love the actress, Alexandra Shipp.
Yeah.
She looks wonderful. She looks pretty menacing at times, shooting her lightning bolts. But I just don't like her as a horseman of Apocalypse. She doesn't have much agency herself. Maybe at least until the very end when she turns good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, again, Storm never served properly in these movies. It's pretty sad. It's just like, I mean,
here's hoping. Future.
Yeah, exactly. Also, we get the character of Caliban, who can sort of detect mutants. He'll more interestingly be played by Stephen Merchant in the next movie, Logan. A totally different actor and almost like a pretty much a different character, but again, using it's just, there's a lot of just always weird stuff in these movies. And that's weird to even bring up because this movie sets up Logan in a weird way at the very end with the post-credits scene.
Right.
Let's just talk about it now. The post-credits scene, it's the Weapon X facility, Weapon X escaped, and they're collecting Wolverine's DNA, the Essex Corp. Which is something to do with Mr. Sinister, and they're like planning to like clone him,
right.
Which is what the little girl is, X-23, in the Logan movie, his daughter, more or less.
Yeah,
she's a clone of him.
Right.
So, you know, like it's weird that this movie will jump into Logan, but
does cloning work like that?
That you can like get a different gender?
Yeah,
I have no idea. That's a good question, though.
Talk about that more later.
Right. So, basically, Apocalypse wants to gather some horsemen. He wants to take over the world. Storm is—he actually fools Storm because they show he like he's speaking to her in ancient like Egyptian or something. And he says, "I want to cleanse the world." She's like, "What do you say?" He's like, "Oh, I want to save the world."
Yeah,
and he twirls his mustache.
Right.
She's like, "Okay, I'll follow you." so he's gathering his characters. He finds Angel, turns him into Archangel. Psylocke is like, "I'll help you find the mutants you need." And the first one she takes him to is Angel, who sucks.
Yeah.
And, like, he's not that useful. He can just fly around. You know, he gives him the metal wings that can shoot darts, but, like, great, you know. What else was I going to say about Psylocke and Angel? I don't know. They suck. Like, he spends a lot of time turning him... what I want to say. We were watching the movie, and we're like, the X-Men cartoon did this so much better.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't a reimagining of the comics. The cartoon is not what happens in the comics. It's how Archangel gets his powers. It's close, but they reimagine it for a more dramatic narrative, like visual storytelling, right?
Yeah.
And as you remember in the cartoon, like, Warren Worthington's this tortured guy who he's self-loathing, hates his powers, and he willingly gives himself over to Dr. Adler, who promises to cure him of his mutancy. And it's this whole elaborate machine that shoots him with energy that turns him into Archangel, and Mystique is secretly Dr. Adler.
Right.
And he's double crossed. And that's even more tragic. That shit is interesting.
Yeah. What should have been in the movie.
What we get in this movie is Apocalypse lovingly touching Angel's face and like out of magic turns him into Archangel and like keeps like, and then we cut away, something else happens, and we cut back to him and he's still touching Angel and like giving him more different body armor types. It's ridiculous. they cut back to the mansion. Cyclops is like really like antsy. He's like, I want to go to the mall. And he goes to the mall with Nightcrawler and Jean and Jubilee. And this whole scene is cut from the movie. You can look it up online.
Yeah.
And that was actually a fun scene. One of the better deleted scenes where they go to the mall and they have some fun.
Yeah. Well, because it's actually like you're spending a little time with these new characters and getting to know how they are and who they are.
And you're getting across the main point of why you're seeing this movie in the 80s anyway, is to show like mutants in the
80s. Yeah.
And like teens and stuff in the 80s. And they cut that whole sequence out of the film.
Yeah.
It's a big mistake.
Silly.
So then they get Magneto. He's the crowning piece in Apocalypse's.
That's the fourth horseman.
Right. Magneto's about to kill everyone at the Iron Plant in an act of revenge.
Right.
Apocalypse is like, don't bother them. I'll kill them instantly.
Yeah.
Which is just so weird, you know? Like, just the way they're just... the narrative is stepping over itself in all these different scenes. Mm-hmm. And the character motivations are sort of, like, introduced and then thrown out the window. And Apocalypse... This is the most controversial scene in the movie. Apocalypse takes him to Auschwitz in a teleportation portal. Mm-hmm. And Magneto's like, you should not have brought me here. And it's like, yeah, you should not have. Like, yeah. It's just, like, inappropriate, I think, to go to the real Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they actually filmed there or not. It's probably a recreation.
Probably a set.
But he's like, Apocalypse is trying to convince him to join a side. He's like, don't you want to destroy the systems that slaughtered your people? He's like, yeah, I guess I do. And you get this one over-the-top sequence of Magneto destroying Auschwitz.
Right.
Which, at this point, I'm guessing is a museum. To teach people about the Holocaust.
Yeah, right.
So to destroy this version of Auschwitz is kind of like, I'm not saying it's bad to destroy Auschwitz because it's a place of pure evil, but you know the reason it still stands to this day is to serve as a reminder to the human race that genocide is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So to have Magneto kill it is just like something not either appropriate or it misses the mark, you know, for a lot of different reasons. It's not like, you know, it's not satisfying to me as like a Jewish person to see him do it.
Mm.
It's not like it's unsatisfying. Like, it makes me feel nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it evokes any emotion in me.
Right. And it's you just, would think it would be something that should be like emotional in some way.
I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but like, did you feel anything when he destroys Auschwitz?
I mean, no, but I thought the point was more to like give Magneto a small dose of catharsis, you know?
Yeah.
And like show him how his... Because Apocalypse also, like, supercharges his powers, right?
Right, supposedly.
So he's like, all right, put your hand to the ground, and, you know, you can, like, get all the metals out of the earth if you want to.
Right.
So, like, try it. So he does, and I thought the idea is, like, okay, now Magneto sees that this can be used for something, and it's in, like, this place that has a lot of meaning for him. So it's not about meaning for us, really. It's, like, it's winning him over so that now he's going to go help Apocalypse do, like, this same thing on, like, a global scale, and how much better is that going to feel?
Right. So, and then I guess it's at this point my eyes are kind of rolling over because the plot's moving along where Apocalypse realizes either through Magneto or someone else that Professor X with Cerebro is going to be very useful to his plans.
Yeah.
So Professor X is reaching out to trying to find Magneto, and because Apocalypse is in the room with Magneto, he senses Professor X. He hijacks Professor X's mind for the moment. So it's like weirdly Apocalypse has some kind of telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What's going on?
Yeah, I don't know either.
Anyway, so he takes over Cerebro, and by using Cerebro, he takes over all the world's nuclear missile command centers, launches all the missiles into the outer space so that they can't be used, which is actually a really cool sequence and a cool idea. I mean, it smacks of Superman from Superman 4.
Mm-hmm.
What's that movie called? Something of Peace. It's driving me crazy. I can't remember it. But in Superman 4, Superman... gathers up all the world's nuclear missiles and launches them into outer space.
Right.
Where
I thought they were going with this was that he was gonna then like detonate them, like send them back to the Earth.
Right. Kill everybody. Everywhere. That would have achieved the same effect he was going for at the end of the movie. Anyway, he wanted to kill everybody.
It's too apocalyptic.
I guess he just wanted to show mankind that he's more powerful than them, and it's like a thing. It's like your hubris doesn't match mine.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a cool sequence, and we see Stan Lee in probably his most touching cameo ever, with holding his wife Joni as they're watching the missiles launch up into the sky reflected in his sunglasses. It's pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, Professor X at this point is freaking out, like he finally sees what Apocalypse is. Apocalypse teleports into the X mansion. His intention is to kidnap Professor X. Oh, before that happens, Professor X tells Havoc to wreak havoc. He needs the Cerebro destroyed so Apocalypse can't use it.
Mm.
And I guess that's mission accomplished. But Professor X does get kidnapped.
He does use the phrase wreak havoc, which is just
dumb. I mean, it's well delivered by McAvoy, but still, it's pretty stupid. Hammy screenwriting.
Yeah.
As Professor X is getting kidnapped, Havok dies.
Yeah.
Like, because he accidentally blows up a nuclear reactor they have in the X-Mansion.
Right.
And the explosion envelops him as Apocalypse gets away. Meanwhile, the other X-Men are just returning from the movies. They saw Return of the Jedi. They're saying the third Star Wars movie is the worst one.
Because the third one is always the worst one.
Right. Ha-ha. Which is like a joke on, I guess, X-Men 3, when Bryan Singer left the franchise.
Yeah.
And it ended up being an inadvertent burn on his own movie here, which everyone knows. Yeah. So, like, really talking about hubris a lot on the part of Bryan Singer here. Mm-hmm. Then Quicksilver is reintroduced in the movie. He lets the audience know that Magneto's my father. I don't know what I'm going to do about it.
Yeah.
So he runs to the X-Mansion to meet Xavier to help him with this.
No, he's looking for Magneto.
Oh, but he goes to the X-Mansion, though, to find him, right? He thinks he's there.
Yeah.
So he shows up at, like, the precise nick of time, like, in the biggest coincidences of all coincidences.
Just as this enormous explosion is happening.
Right.
And so you have, like, that... I mean, it's a really great scene, actually. Like, these are always successful so far.
Yeah.
You know?
The movie, like, stops, but it's for a lot of fun.
Right, yeah.
And it makes you kind of forgive a lot of the crap you've seen up to this point.
Right. Super slow-mo. He, like, goes around the mansion saving everybody systematically and just,
set to Sweet Dreams by the Eurythmics.
Yeah, right.
Is that the name of that song?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's fun. Evan Peters, again, delivers another great performance in the X-Men movies.
Yeah, he's great.
He's probably way too superpowered for what Quicksilver is supposed to be, but whatever.
Yeah.
It works. It's fine. I love the one shot when he's riding the table that he kicks out the window and holding the two kids, and it's a close-up on his face.
Uh-huh.
And the Sweet Dreams chorus is really kicking the gear. You see the explosion of the X-Mansion.
He's, like, surfing out of there on the
right.
table.
That's pretty iconic. Superhero shot.
Yeah,
it's like, that's why I go to superhero movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't lie. When I first saw the scene, I had the biggest, stupidest, goofiest grin on my face. And, like, let me just take a break here to say that I really enjoyed this movie when I first saw it.
Yeah.
I borderline loved it.
Uh-huh.
Like, everything, like, this whole movie is like a big, like, gloss of X-Men pixie dust across your eyes when you first see it.
Right.
Because you're like, oh, wow, yeah, Cyclops, Jean, hooray, they're back. Cool, Apocalypse.
All my friends.
Like, the X-Men are young and interesting again. And, you know, it looks good. And, oh, this Quicksilver scene is a lot of fun. And, yes, it's pretty stupid, but, you know, I'm just enjoying myself. So I can't lie. I enjoyed this movie when I first saw it.
Yeah, I did
And I'll
too.
Always have, like, a weird soft spot for it in that point of view.
Uh-huh.
It's just replaying it several times. I've probably watched it a half a dozen times since. Uh-huh. It's just the flaws become more glaringly obvious, and then you get angrier because you realize, like, they shortchanged the whole, like, mythos of the comic book, you know?
Yeah,
I know. All right. So, Havok is dead. The other X-Men are saved. Now the movie is, like, finally starting to, like, cohere a little bit more. The Weapon X special ops people, led by the young Stryker actor, shows up at the X-Mansion. They kidnap all the mutants. They've got some kind of, like, mutant, like, debilitating gun.
Mm-hmm.
Also, their helicopters have, like, mutant-proof energy shields in them, conveniently. They kidnap all the mutants, including Moira McTaggart. Cyclops, Jean, and Nightcrawler are left behind. Jean uses her powers to sneak on board a helicopter with them. They remain invisible. They end up flying to Alkali Lake in Canada. What else? Like, and then all the other mutants are trapped in this cage or something by Stryker. And I guess their powers aren't supposed to be working, yet somehow Mystique's power is still working because she's still in blonde Jennifer Lawrence mode.
Yeah.
You know? And then, at this point, Apocalypse broadcasts a message across the world saying that you're all doomed except for the strong. The strong will survive, the weak will be killed.
Uh-huh.
In the midst of this, Professor X lets out a secret message to Jean to say, like, where he is and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's like, Jean. To me, that's, like, classic Professor X stuff.
Yeah.
I really like that moment.
That's good. Yeah, that's good comic sourcing.
Right. And good, like, cartoon referencing to...
Yeah.
There's a scene or two in the cartoon where he's like, mutant.
Yeah.
He may even call out to Jean like that, too, at
times.
So I appreciated that. Meanwhile, Cyclops, Jean, and Nightcrawler are running around the Weapon X facility. They discover Hugh Jackman in a surprise cameo. He's trapped in the Weapon X cage.
Uh-huh.
He's wearing the comic accurate, like, headpiece and, like, computer belt that he has from the Weapon X comic.
Yeah.
And they let him loose. Interestingly, He looks really good as Weapon X here.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, he's wearing that comic accurate outfit, although he's not butt naked as he is in the comics.
Right.
His hair looks more like Wolverine than it ever did in any movie.
It's shapely.
It's more shaped in that weird, like, rectangle shape. And his mutton chops are, like, really crazy looking.
Again, like, the timeline age thing is so weird in this scene, you know? Because it's like, Jean grows up and he loves her, but, like, it's whatever. He's older than everyone and he always looks the same. So with him, it's more fine. But
right.
It's just...
Whatever. Again, it didn't make sense how he ended up in this facility at the end of the last movie, considering Mystique was the one who saved him.
Right.
Like, no one's ever going to be able to explain that to me. Weirdly, he's not as, like, jacked and ripped as he is in other movies. His muscle definition is way less sharp. I'm sure, like, you know, famously, if you read about what it takes for him to be Wolverine, he has to go into the gym for 6 months and work out like a maniac. And we talked about in the last podcast how he has to dehydrate himself to have his six-pack shine through.
Yeah.
But so here he wasn't going to do that. He's like, I'll be in this movie, but, you know.
It's fair. I don't blame him.
Right. I mean, why is he in this movie? Again, it doesn't make much sense.
Because you can't have an X-Men movie without Wolverine, that's why.
Right. So, well, he wasn't in Deadpool 1 or 2.
Those are not technically X-Men movies.
Yes, they are.
They're Deadpool movies.
Yeah, all right, that's fine. And he does kind of show up in Deadpool 2 in, like, a weird... like archival footage way.
Yeah.
And I guess he shows up in Deadpool 1 with the picture of his Hugh Jackman's face stapled to Deadpool's head.
Yeah,
so
right.
he was there in spirit. Anyway, they let Wolverine free. He kills a bunch of guards. And this is another thing that was like a magic trick at the time. You see, it's like, yeah, finally, we've seen the Weapon X, the bloody murder spree that we never got in the movies.
Yeah.
But it's like really when you watch the scene the second time, you're like, wait, it's not that bloody. It's just as kind of bloodless as it always is.
Yeah, it's kind of bloody.
A little bit, you
there's
know?
Blood sprays.
But they show a lot of direct stabbings, but there's no blood. It's not like what we're going to see in Logan. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not as all right
with it. Especially when we see Logan, it's way more satisfying.
Okay.
Before Wolverine runs off in, like, the weirdest shot ever, like this middle distance shot of him running into the Canadian snow. Right. Yeah, Red Letter Media pointed that out to me when they reviewed this movie for the first time, how weird that shot looks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But, like, Jean unlocks the memory of his name, at the very least, in his brain. Yeah. I guess not, like, his real name, which is James Howlett. Right. She just remembers the Logan part of his name. So,
set for that next movie.
Right. And in the weird way, her psychic connection to Wolverine, like, sets up the fact that why he's inexplicably attracted to her going forward.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, they manage to free the other X-Men from the torture chamber. Well, it's not a torture chamber, but prison. Meanwhile, Apocalypse and his gang are, like, sitting in, like, some rocks outside of Cairo, just staring at the city. And Apocalypse begins to destroy the city.
Mm-hmm.
He builds a massive pyramid out of nothing in, like, 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Which is kind of visually interesting, and it's like, wow, Apocalypse is really powerful. But, like, it kind of just makes you wonder...
Oh, he builds it? I thought the thing was that he, like, cleared away the buildings and stuff that were on top because it was the pre-existing pyramid from
before. Oh, really? Was it? No, I thought that pyramid got destroyed. This is a new pyramid because it's, like, made of metal and stuff.
Okay.
I think he, like, uses dust from the city, like, of cars and things.
Yeah.
You see
the dust
gather up and make a metallic shiny pyramid.
That makes sense.
So he's, like, killing untold hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, in Cairo. The X-Men, meanwhile, they find this cool, like, bird-looking plane at the Weapon X facility. Not quite the Blackbird, but sort of like it. And there's also conveniently X-Men uniforms, which they just refer to as flight suits. Somehow they fit all these characters, men and women of different shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
So they're flying in, and then Magneto, as they're flying in, Mystique gives this, like, rah-rah speech to the other X-Men, like, mentioning the other movies. And
that's so weird.
It's so bizarre. It's out of character.
Yeah.
It comes off as poorly acted, and it's just not good writing.
I mean, I understand she's been around longer, so they want to give that to her, and also because it's Jennifer Lawrence. But, like, if anything, like you said, Cyclops should have been the one. You know, it's
right.
Like he lost his brother. He's found his new calling.
Or, at
like,
the very least, Beast in that moment, because he's been an X-Man for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make sense because she's coming off like this character of authority, which they try to establish in the movie that she's this hero around the world to all mutants, like good and bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cyclops and Jean see that to her, like, you've been my hero since I was 10 years old.
That's weird.
It's just bizarre. It doesn't strike a good note. Magneto, meanwhile, is destroying the world at Apocalypse's request. He's, like, accessing the magnetic like crust of the center of the earth.
Yeah.
And they cut to some military guys saying, like, the world will be destroyed within anything built after the Bronze Age will be destroyed at the end of the day. Which is weird, like, comment to slip in there. And, you know, we see various famous landmarks get destroyed. New York is getting quite fucked up. The Manhattan Bridge gets ripped apart. The Sydney Opera House gets destroyed. And like I said, all Cairo is laid waste. So, I mean, millions of people must be dying, I think, around the world at Magneto's hand, who does not seem to be brainwashed. He's just in a dark place. So he's a mass murderer in this movie. And then, the, you know, like, and then the X-Men land in Cairo. The fight sequence begins. Quicksilver and Mystique go to confront Magneto. He does have a Magneto bubble, which I complained about in the other podcast that we never seen with the shield. But this is like kind of made more of metal, and electricity, and not electricity, just like floating particles, and they push against it like it's a cushion.
Yeah,
I would have liked to see again like a electric ball shield.
Oh.
That's just me. Like what we see in the cartoons.
This was okay.
Yeah, it was interesting visually. But anyway, at this moment, Mystique's like, "You have like not all is lost, Eric. You have more to fight for. People still care about you, like me." And she looks at Quicksilver.
She's like, here's your cue.
Yeah, and he's like, he can't say. He's like, he should have said, I'm your son.
Yeah.
And that should have been the thing that turned him.
Right.
And the fact that the movie doesn't go there is so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
Why not admit you're his son? Like, have that be the motive. The whole movie's setting up this moment.
Right.
That's
they want more suspense. They want it to happen, like, in a later movie.
I mean,
I don't understand.
The reason he turns in the end, he just sees Mystique being choked, which I guess would mean something to him, but...
Right.
I don't know, like...
He could have gotten there at, like, a much more emotional, visceral level.
Right, yeah. He could have been shocked. And, you know, Quicksilver's like, listen, like, I, you know, I don't know how to feel about it. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you see, you don't haven't lost your whole family. And, like, by the way, I've got a sister, too, who apparently is your child.
Right.
You know, meanwhile, the X-Men are fighting the Four Horsemen. Angel's fighting Nightcrawler. It's, like, not that interesting of a fight, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because they're fighting in this, like, big clusterfuck of dust and, like, dark clouds.
Yeah.
And I don't, and the pyramid that they're in is has no, like, remarkable...
Right. Oh, yeah, so then, like, Apocalypse is in the pyramid, and he's got James McAvoy.
Right. His plan, if we haven't mentioned, is he wants to transfer his consciousness into James McAvoy.
Yeah, so he can be in the platform set up.
He wants to be in the mind of every person on Earth, brainwash them all to be his slave. Which, I mean, there won't be that many left over when the world's destroyed. I don't know what he's trying to do.
But
anyway, in the process of that, Professor X loses his hair,
which
is really stupid.
Yeah.
So, okay, as we all know. But, you know, in the midst of that, Professor X is fighting Apocalypse on the mental plane.
Right.
And at first, Professor X feels like he's got the advantage. You know, this is my house. And he starts... But it's like their projection of a fight in the mental plane is them in a fist fight.
Stupid.
Which is so dumb. Like, we've seen from Legion, from the cartoons and the comics, when you get into a mental fight, like, you have these big, like, beautiful scenes of, like, purple and yellow energy fighting in outer space.
I mean, you could make it anything is the point.
Right,
why would you resort to, like, the same thing that you have in real life?
Right, we've seen Professor X in these psychic visions, like, dress up like an old, like, Japanese soldier, you know, like, wearing Japanese armor and stuff and fighting on a horse with, like, a lance. We've seen, like, all manner of things, you know? Like, it could literally be anything. Instead, he's fighting in the X-Mansion, and they're fist fighting.
Right, and Apocalypse grows to be, like, giant size.
Right.
Which he should be able to do in real life, too.
Which he doesn't, right. Apocalypse grows only in the mental projection. Somehow that's enough to best Professor X, the most powerful psychic in the world.
Yeah.
Like, Professor X should also be able to grow. And, like,
right, it's a mental projection.
Right. So he gets beat up in a dream, essentially.
Right.
And then... you know, what else happens? Then Magneto eventually turns. He sees Apocalypse choking Mystique. Apocalypse breaks Quicksilver's leg, gets him out of the game. Magneto sees Apocalypse choking Mystique. He finally has... His heart wakes up. He stops destroying the world. He, like, hammers down two steel girders that make an X.
Stupid.
Which is dumb. I mean, yeah, it's... I don't know. Right, it's stupid. You're right. Magneto says, like, I remembered... Apocalypse says, you betrayed me. And Magneto says, no, I remembered I was betraying my friends.
Yeah.
Or other mutants, I guess. So he starts, like, hurling an unending stream of metal shit at Apocalypse. He can block it with a fire shield somehow.
I know. Meanwhile, Professor X is, like, calling out to Jean. He's
right,
like,
because he's half dead.
Right. He's like, Apocalypse, like, you're never going to win because you're alone and I'm not.
Right.
And
this is a pretty, like, good line.
Yeah, which, like, okay, you know, you're, like, showing the team support, whatever, that's right. good. But he's calling out to Jean, and I thought for sure, like, in real life, Jean is, like, hovering over Professor X's face. I thought maybe she's going to, like, put her hands on his head or, like, something, like, help him in this mental fight.
Right.
But instead, she walks away from him and she, like, hovers in the air out there and
turns into the Phoenix. Yeah.
Which...
The only good thing I'll say about it is that the Firebird at the very end, when she's done being the Phoenix, looks pretty good.
Yeah.
It looks like the comics.
Yeah.
But everything else, like, this knot should be where we see the Phoenix. You've again messed up the Phoenix saga.
Yeah.
It's going to be ruined in the next movie. It's too soon, too. She's too young. You know, yeah. She's 16. She shouldn't be the Phoenix yet. You just don't know what the Phoenix is, Simon Kinberg and Brian Singer. Like, Jesus Christ. But yeah, so they're also in the midst of this fight, Storm sees Mystique being choked, and that's her hero. So she turns to a good guy, and she starts blasting lightning at Apocalypse. Cyclops, too, is shooting his optic beam. So Cyclops doesn't have the visor yet, and this is a nitpick that bothered me. He just has his eyes wide open, and he's shooting straight ahead. But my problem with this, and this is a little bit technical and nerdy, I guess, but the whole point of the visor is what allows him to shoot a narrow beam that's like a straight line. When his eyeballs are wide open,
it should be his whole field
of vision. Right. It's like, right? An enormous, yeah. like blasting out of energy in a way bigger circumference of space,
yeah.
volume of space. Here, it's like his eyes are open. It's just shooting straight from his eyeballs, straight ahead.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't look right. I mean, like, visually, it does not look right. And it, again, strikes another note that doesn't takes me out of it as an X-Men fan. Right. Not the biggest deal, but whatever. He gets his visor at the end of the movie.
Right.
So they're all blasting Apocalypse to shit. Apocalypse gives up when he sees the Phoenix. He's like, oh, the prophecy is foretold or something. Like, I guess he knows about the Phoenix. And she, they evaporate Apocalypse into, like, a gruesome dust. Kind of like the shades of the end of Indiana Jones when the villains get turned into skeletons and things.
Right.
So Apocalypse is taken care of. Angel dies in the midst of this fight. Psylocke slinks away into the night as an unredeemed bad guy. Professor X restores Moira's memories.
Right. And then she's about to, like, respond to him and say something interesting.
Right.
But
like,
then
is she,
like,
annoyed? Is she happy?
You don't know. She, right. like, a tear runs down her cheek, and instead of actually letting her convey her thoughts and feelings.
An interesting moment in the movie, right.
Like, shift away from that real quick.
Right, yeah. Nightcrawler wakes up, too, and he's like, oh, what's happening? And then they're like, oh, womp womp, scene's over.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so I guess Moira doesn't feel grossly violated that Professor X, like, wiped out half her brain. Meanwhile, cut to the X-Mansion. It's being rebuilt by Jean and Magneto through psychic power and magnetic power, which is a classic X-Men trope, as we've discussed many times in the cartoon, the comics, and the shows, and the movies. The X-Mansion's always blowing up. It's a joke made in one of the Deadpool movies, too. Magneto, or Professor X, mentions that the missiles are being rebuilt around the world, the nuclear missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an interesting conversation about that watching the movie. It's like, would that happen?
Would that really happen? I mean, that would be, in a way, like a nice clean slate for the Earth, wouldn't it? Like, if no one had nuclear missiles, and
I think, like,
everyone just agreed, like, all right, like, that, like, part of our history is finished. Let's leave it behind us. Like, that would be so awesome.
That'd be a nice idealistic. I feel like 99% of the world would react that way. It's like, wow, the scourge of nuclear war is, like, erased.
Right.
This is, like, a chance to start over, like you said.
But
I think the reality of geopolitical what have you, you know,
like
geopolitical forces.
There'd be one person or, like, one country that wouldn't go for it.
Yeah, the plans to build them still exist, right?
Yeah,
so it's like, if one country starts making them, then another country has to make them.
Yeah, right.
And then that's why you have to rebuild them. And I mean, like, the argument for nuclear weapons, and I don't really know how I feel about it. I mean, I believe that I ultimately feel like we shouldn't have them.
Yeah.
But, like, the argument is, like, well, it really does create peace between these enormous superpowers, because we don't, it's never going to be like World War II again, where you can just conventionally roll tanks and an invasion army into someone's, like, land territory, because the second you do that, you'll just nuke their capital and destroy their entire civilian population.
Mm.
Like that. But so having a nuclear ICBMs across the Earth, it allows these countries to, like, you can't use your conventional armies.
Yeah.
Everyone
has defense.
I mean, they've found a way to still use them in our fucked up world, where, like, they wage war in these, like, crappier, weaker countries.
Mm.
And then that doesn't even work either, as we've discovered, you know, like, because it's like a guerrilla resistance is like can somehow hold against the might of either the USSR, as we saw in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. or the USA, as we've seen in Afghanistan, you know?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, our modern tanks and B-12 bombers can't, like, squelch out, like, civilian, you know, populations in that way.
Yeah.
So, that's interesting. But the point is, I think they're right. I think missiles would be rebuilt. Anyway, Magneto... Professor X lets Magneto off the hook yet again.
Right.
And this time, Magneto's really killed a lot of people. Like we said, presumably at his own free will, and the fact that it's just a joke that Magneto, like, walks away is ridiculous, right?
On friendly terms.
Right, yeah. It's like, well, old friend, now I'm in my, like, cool, like, black turtleneck and, you know...
Ready to be Steve Jobs.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, I'm off to be an international man of mystery again. Maybe I'll find a new family and start a, you know, have another child somewhere. And yeah. I'll go to South America this time. Like, who knows, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just bizarre that Professor X lets him get away, and then we cut to the Danger Room, which is now a thing. The X-Men all have fancy new outfits, reminiscent, I guess, of the Jim Lee costumes, though not quite. I mean, the closest one is really Cyclops, because he's got the, like, the Y, like, arm chest band things. You know what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the Cyclops outfit we saw from the cartoons.
Yeah.
I mean, not quite, like, there, but... Like I said in another episode, I'd like to see the gold visor show up for Cyclops. Stop with the silver visor stuff. But they're still wearing bulky body armor. It doesn't look. It's not like they got like they finally got the classic costumes from the comic books and the movies. They still like shortchange them. You know what I mean? And then bizarrely, Mystique is leading them as a team, giving this like militaristic speech to them. Everything you knew before doesn't count. Now you are X-Men. The stakes couldn't be higher.
Yeah.
And she's like, almost like Lee Emery from Full Metal Jacket. Your lives are mine, numbnuts. Like,
yeah.
You're going to face shit like you've never seen.
Right. I mean, once again, could have been Cyclops or Beast.
It should have been Professor X at the very least giving the speech.
Exactly.
And that would have, like, added a weird dimension to his character where he's like, wow, he's...
Accepting, like, the stakes.
That he needs soldiers, and that he's kind of a wacko himself, you know? Instead, it's Mystique giving... I mean, they show Professor X in the background looking kind of like a badass, bald, finally.
Yeah.
Like, staring on approvingly with a scowl on his face. But it would have been more emotional if he gave the speech.
Yeah.
And Mystique should have been, like, slunk off at the end of that battle, too.
Yeah.
With Psylocke somewhere.
Right.
She should not be leading the X-Men. So then the movie ends, and then we talked about the post-credit sequence about Logan.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk about our final feelings about this film.
Okay.
It's a shame. I don't know. On one level, it's fun, it's colorful, it's schlocky.
Yeah.
So if you can appreciate a movie on that level, it's like X-Men Origins Wolverine again, but better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can appreciate that in a movie, I'd recommend it.
Yeah.
I mean, I do recommend it. I have a weird fondness for it. I enjoyed seeing it with you in the movie theater in 2016, that summer.
Uh-huh.
It was a fun summer movie to see.
Uh-huh. It was a fun winter movie again. I still like it.
Did you enjoy rewatching it?
I did, yeah. We just spent like an hour complaining about it.
Right.
And like there are problems. There's always going to be problems. And like, I don't know, is it that we're really nitpicky because we're like so entrenched in the world of the X-Men? Or are they like actually problems? I don't think so.
I think this movie was a dud for fans in the end. The movie did make money. It had a budget of like $173 million. It made $578 million.
Mm-hmm.
How much for marketing? It didn't make that much money. It was like the biggest modern failure of the X-Men movies commercially. But they were able to convince the cast to come back one more time,
right.
Including Fassbender and Jennifer Lawrence, who said she was done with them after this movie. But I guess the paycheck was big enough.
Right.
So they're going to be back for Dark Phoenix, the final real one of this universe.
Yeah.
I mean, supposedly, the release date keeps getting pushed back. You know, it's been in the can for a long time.
Right. Well, isn't a lot of that because they keep showing it to test audiences of fans and
it's,
like...
It's a terrible... The new movie is supposed to be really bad.
Yeah.
It's a huge dud.
Right.
It's... I mean, they brought Simon Kinberg, who wrote a bunch of these movies, including this one, to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why people thought that was a good idea. He's never directed before.
Right.
I'm not saying like a first-time director can't be good, but he's just... I mean, really, he's a Hollywood hack. I mean, Simon Kinberg, you know. Like, I don't know, maybe he's done something good, I have no idea, but, like, I know he's done a bunch of bad X-Men movies.
Yeah.
Or had a hand in a bunch of bad ones.
Right. Right, so, and, like, that's one of the biggest problems, actually, with a lot of these movies, is the script doesn't ring true.
Yeah, I mean, the scripts aren't, like, the actors are there, they're game, they want it. I mean, Oscar Isaac, I'm sure, signed up, because, well, it's probably a big paycheck more than anything, but still, it's like, a lot of A-list actors are in these movies.
Yeah.
So, I don't think we can expect much hope for X-Men Dark Phoenix, maybe we'll be surprised.
But we're gonna see it.
I mean, yeah, we're going to see it. So, podcast or not, we would have seen it.
Yeah.
You know, for me, rewatching this, it's like all those happy memories I had when I first saw it, they're just really gone. And it was just boring for me and the slog and all the bad negative stuff stood out.
Well, because you've seen it 6 times.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
I don't think I've seen it since the theaters. So I still have, like, happy memories from going to the theater and, like, munching some popcorn during the summer and,
right.
You know.
All right, so let's give it a rating out of 6 Wolverine Claws.
I think I've given 4 out of 6 to, like, most of these movies. I'm gonna stay consistent. 4 out of 6.
I'm gonna give it a 3 out of 6. It's like a middle of the road 50 out of 100. You know, like I guess that's a failure in the scholastic terms.
Uh-huh.
But, like, totally average. You know, yeah. Average of good and bad stuff. It's just a shame, ultimately, for me that the new X-Men cast was not utilized. They're supposed to be the stars of the movie, and they're, like, real all side characters, And it seems like it's going to be the same problem the next one, because you still have Magneto and Mystique playing prominent roles.
Yeah, so. It's too much of not the right things.
Right.
But despite all the problems, I was still happy to see Oscar Isaac, and I was still happy to see Apocalypse, and...
I don't know, it's wasted. Because I know that Marvel's going to take over the X-Men movies at some point, and I don't know, it's, you know, if they didn't do Apocalypse in this one, that would have been a perfect character to have in their arsenal.
Still do it, doesn't matter.
And not right away, they're going to have to do something different. They can't just reboot Apocalypse as a villain. They'll do Mr. Sinister or something.
Yeah, right.
John Hamm is Mr. Sinister, as he supposedly is the cameo of New Mutants, another movie that may or may never come out. That's all I got for this week. I want to say, you may not hear from us next week. Next week being Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, we might take a week off.
We'll see. If we don't, it's going to be some weird bonus episode of I don't have any good ideas yet. So if people in the audience, like, want us to cover something specifically that we can do in one episode, let us know. And even then, we might not be able to do it because of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But rest assured, we'll be back the following week with Logan to finally close out the X-Men movies, finally close out the X-Men portion of this podcast,
yeah,
and move on to Spider-Man. So keep that in mind. Let us know if there's some, like, singular thing we should do. Like, I was thinking about doing Generation X, maybe, that made for TV Fox TV movie.
Oh yeah,
with Jubilee's the star. It's on YouTube for free, but I don't know, it's like an hour and a half long, and that's like, that's like gonna be like doing another movie. I don't know if I can deal with that, but that could, maybe we will, I don't know.
Okay.
But if you have a better idea, let me know. Like some one-off cartoon movie, something we should do, let me know. Follow us at Facebook at X-Men Task Podcast. Search us out there where you could communicate to us your ideas and interact with us. Follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Rate and review us 5 stars in your various podcast services that you use. Sonia, any final words?
I wish I had my ocarina.
Okay, very good. Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.